Hello and welcome back to the Careless Talk Climbing Podcast with Sam Pryor and Aidan Roberts. Was a bit worried about the last episode because here we are talking to such a well-accomplished climber and we're releasing this whole podcast episode where we don't even talk about climbing at all. But thanks everyone who got in touch to say that they enjoyed it. Because it does open up an avenue for us to sometimes not just kind of talk about the same old climbing things over and over again. And I do feel like if we want a little bit of longevity in the game, then we want to be able to expand our horizons a bit and talk about things that interest us that isn't just kind of, you know, tell us your hardest climb and how did you do it? But that's not to say that we're not going to talk about those things, because those things are interesting. It just won't be every time. But this time is one of those times, because this is the parts of the Dave McLeod episode where we actually did speak about climbing, which is quite a shock on a climbing podcast, I know. But here is again the two of the most soothing, soporific voices in the game, Aidan Roberts and Dave McLeod. So again, a reminder not to listen to this one while you're operating heavy machinery. All right, cheers, thanks for listening, guys.
Talking about climbing,
certainly.
Yeah, it's a bit of climbing. What have you been up to recently, Dave? Have you got anything you're currently working on?
Well, quite often in December I tend to boulder. I do a fair bit of winter climbing as well, but although there is some conditions, I usually wait till a bit later. So the whole of December, I've just been bouldering, just working on projects. And there are a lot of new boulder problems all over Scotland, but also just quite close to where I live. So I tend to, in the first half of the winter, I just work on hard projects, things that I can't really do yet. I do like trying stuff that's a bit beyond my limit and takes me a fair bit of time to do. I just really enjoy working out sequences.
Yeah, I've seen a video on your Instagram of you working, looks like the very, very start of something hard.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an amazing project. I tried that one, I think, in 2016 the first time. And it was one of the few like projects that I've tried that I've thought, no, there's no point. I'll just walk away from that one. It's just too hard. I just couldn't seem to unlock it at all. And then I can't even remember what made me go back to it. I think it was this year, when I'd completed another one that I'd been trying for a long time. I thought, well, I'll just go back and have another look, and it'll just be a kind of fun session just to even see if there's any difference from 4 years ago. But then you just find different beta, and then
is the end of it a bit easier than the start of it?
Yeah, I think the first four moves are probably in the 40B region, and then I think you go along this lip, and that bit's about 7C plus or so. But it's sustained, so it'll be extremely hard for me to link.
Is this the project, the steep face and quite undercutty?
Yeah
the rock looks amazing. Is it schist, the rock?
It is schist.
It looks really nice.
Yeah, it's very good. And then actually it's got a high ball finish. It goes up this big arete, which is easy, but it's actually quite a long problem.
Oh cool. Yeah, no, it's cool. I actually came up to Scotland bouldering the first time this summer. Yeah. It's amazing that I had a really psychological barrier getting up there. But I think in my mind it was a lot further than I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And also it was a lot harder. I mean, I appreciate I got lucky with conditions. I went in July and it was really windy, not that warm. Yeah. And not midgy, which I appreciate is rare.
Yes.
but I was really impressed. I'm really excited to spend some more time up there.
I mean, for you, there's just so much to go at. I mean, there's so many things that I know about that are too hard for me, but would be spot on for you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, it definitely seems to be a slightly untapped. It definitely has the reputation in the UK of like holding so much potential, and yet it's quite untapped.
Yes, well, I think that's true. I mean, I've just spent the last 25 years doing new routes and almost nothing else. So yeah, and not running out of them. I mean, just to give an example, like there's this place that I've been going to called Glenpean, just out to the west of Fort William, and that glen has got like endless charge routes, but it's a steep-sided glen with crags on both sides, and the boulders have just fallen into the middle. There's a huge boulder jumble where it's been an old landslip, and it's like four magic woods or something. But you walk around it, and the rock is very compact. Like I walk around all the boulders, going, "That looks a brilliant line, but it's way too hard for me." But you have that over and over again. So wow. It's a very futuristic place, you know. It's like there's a lot of lines where, like, you know, every move just looks insanely hard.
Yeah.
So I mean, that would be. You have a field day there.
Yeah, and yeah. That's quite rare in the UK. Generally, the theme of things we find in the UK is a lack of like really compact rock, which like often we can like, or like the mountainous boulders can lend themselves to quite being over featured. So that kind of thing is, I'm actually really intrigued by that like style of, I remember watching that Glenpean video on your YouTube channel. I think you mostly were doing trad routes there.
Yeah.
But I remember it kind of like taps into a different, discipline, that adventure, more like adventure bouldering, where you maybe would, it maybe be more beneficial to like go there and like set up camp for a few days kind of thing.
Yeah,
it sounded like it was a few hours walk, wasn't it? But
yeah, it's quite a long walk. Yeah, or you can go in a boat and that makes it a bit easier.
Yeah. Oh, right.
That's a cool way to get to a crag.
Got some options. Yeah, it sounds like there's definitely promise. But,
when's the best chance of conditions for that?
I would say the spring. Yeah, so the midges usually come in the middle of May. So the months before that is usually the best time. Or the whole of May can be great. But yeah, the first end of April, first half of May, especially for bouldering, where it's still a bit on the cool side. You got long evenings and just tends to be dry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever considered bouldering in a midge suit like our previous guest, Tim Blake?
No, someone actually made me a full body midge suit for my daughter when she was very small.
Trying to squeeze inside it.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I just tend to avoid the conditions where, I mean, I usually get midged like once or twice in a summer, like fully like attacked. But most of the time I just watch the weather for the wind and just climb where it's windy, and if it's not going to be windy, I just don't go near it.
Well, I climb a lot with Dan Varian, and I mean I hold my hands up, I use fans in summer to get good conditions. I find that helpful, but I quite like it kind of feels analogous in that he is like, actually he's not, I didn't say he's actively against using fans, but doesn't want to use on himself, and he likes the idea of like predicting the weather, being quite engaged with your like local environment. I think it's quite a nice idea, so like, so that he doesn't use a fan and it necessitates him figuring out where is windy on which days, trying to understand your local environment and like the dynamics of the weather. And it feels quite similar to that, which I always think.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the nicest things about Scotland is actually that where I am in the West Highlands, the climate's really different in all directions. So I used to go out to the west at Arisaig, to the Arisaig Cave, which is a great bouldering spot. And you'd drive through the rain shadow in Glenfinnan and then come out at the coast into the sunshine.
Wow.
But you can also do the same going the opposite direction. Where you were bouldering at Laggan, you go along the 86 and into Speyside, and you come out the bad weather and sunshine there.
Yeah, it all flattens out a bit.
Yeah, or up Inverness way. It's all different microclimates in different parts of the country. So you can usually look at the forecast and you will almost always find something. I mean, this month I've been going to a really nice cave. And, you know, one of the days it took me 7 hours to get there in the snow. But it was perfect conditions, you know.
Wow, 7 hours to walk there or to drive?
No, to drive. Just waiting for like cars that were stuck to.
Oh wow!
And things.
Oh god!
Requires a bit of tenacity, hey.
is there like a good guidebook for Scotland? I've not seen like a Boulder Scotland guidebook.
Yeah, there is a Boulder Scotland guidebook. Yeah,
there is.
Yeah,
should have googled it.
Yeah, there's a few. So the Boulder Scotland guidebook has got like a broad overview of the areas with just some classic problems in each. And then there are a couple of older Scottish bouldering guidebooks which are still really useful that have classics. But there's definitely time for another one. But the thing is, there's so much. It would be like having the same as having an England guidebook. It would be just enormous. It would have to be Peak District, Lake District. You mean even the Wales bouldering guidebooks? Like, it's a brick, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's just mountainous North Wales. It's like
Right. Yeah. So you need more than one, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. So there are also some smaller topos. Like there's a good one for Torridon. I really should have done one for Glen Nevis, for example, but I've never got around to it.
It's no minor endeavour, is it?
In the process of a guidebook.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think when you're busy on to new projects, it's quite a big ask to go around filling in all the gaps. And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. The idea has appealed to me before, but I think the more I thought about it, about writing guidebooks, the more I thought about it, the more I understood how ambitious a task it is. I've definitely got a lot of respect for the people that have put in that time.
Yeah, it works well if you know an area really well. Like, you know, I wrote up a guidebook for Dumbarton Rock in a couple of different places because I just knew it inside out. And I did realise at the time that it made sense for me to do it because I actually had done the most there and I really knew it very, very well.
Yeah. So
if you can find people that are like an activist in each area and then collaborate that way, it's probably the best.
Yeah. If you need a handful of books to cover Scotland anyway.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's just in the context of bouldering. No, I really was impressed by that spot. I wanted to ask a little bit on the topic of development, because you seem to, or like most of the bouldering you're doing around there seems to be like new things, working on projects that you've got handfuls of. But it seems, most of it seems you're doing it by yourself, because it's quite dispersed. Lots of like the community of climbers that are developing things in Scotland, it's quite spread out, isn't it?
It's spread out and it's very small. Just the numbers of people is very small. I mean, the issue that I have is that there's not a lot of folk to share projects with that are climbing at the same actual projects, you know. So you know, there's not a scene of people climbing like, you know, 40k plus and above or something like that. So it usually just makes sense for me to go out and try things on my own. And also with the weather situation, and also my own lifestyle of like I tend to work when it's wet, and I tend to go out at very short notice. Like, you know, I'll just watch the weather through the morning and just keep looking at it and then think, yeah, okay, today I'll go. And then, you know, I literally just like, you know, pick up my jacket and leave right then. So it does kind of make it easier to just go. I mean, quite often in different parts of the world in Scotland, we'll meet up with different people just at the crag, where you just bump into people. And that does actually happen quite a lot. And it's one of the things I really like. It's like, I know that I'm going to meet this person or that person in that area at that time of year. And it's good because I do so many different climbing disciplines as well. So, you know, I've always liked that you have a sort of different scene through the summer. Like in the mountain trad, I'll have a small group of people who I would climb with, and you see them for a while during the year. And then in the winter, it's a completely different scene that you're kind of joining into. But I also actually like climbing on my own as well. I've always liked that. I tend to focus better. I quite like training on my own as well. But yeah, I'm just quite introverted.
Yeah. No, I can definitely see the appeal of that. Gives you a lot of freedom.
So would you spend more time going around Scotland repeating things if there were more things to repeat? Is this a bit of a, are you kind of doing first ascents because that's kind of what you have to do hard boulders, or are there lots of things?
Mostly, yes. I mean, I did spend a lot of time repeating the sort of hard things that were around in Scotland about 20 years ago, or more than 20 years ago. But then I did start to run out of especially boulder problems, really, because it was the most underdeveloped area. I mean, there are more now, and there was other people coming and putting up hard problems here and there, and which is absolutely brilliant. But mainly, just was doing first ascents because that there wasn't really much choice for doing hard stuff. But in parallel, I've also come to really enjoy doing that. I mean, it's not related to trying to grab first ascents or anything like that. I'm not bothered about that. I just enjoy the whole process of like finding new boulders. I always have done, and there's a couple of friends, like my friend Michael Tweedley, for years and years he's been brilliant at finding great new venues for bouldering, sport and trad, and he is like me, he also gets very excited about finding new places, and it's just brilliant because he's a hill runner as well, and he'll just go out and every so often he'll send you a picture of something and you're like, wow, that's brilliant, and we both get really excited about going there. And just, we've had like 20 years of or more of developing all these new crags. I mean, I remember like when I lived in Dumbarton in like 2004, Michael was coming over and we were going out to the west and developing all the sport crags at Tinnabrook, these brilliant schist horizontal roofs that all had like nice routes between like 80 plus. And easier ones as well, and we were bolting them and doing all those. And then at the same time, after we'd climbed, we were going out and just running up the glens and just finding boulders that we've since come back to much later and developed. Yeah, it's a great process.
And how useful a feather in the cap being a good runner is when you look at
Yeah, very helpful. Drone operator is probably another popular one. I was wondering if all of that first ascenting has changed the way you climb, because you so often approach even really well-established boulders or routes almost as if you're doing a first ascent. And so often I've seen you do totally ridiculous beaters. I saw you doing it on Keen Roof the other day, and I thought, wow, that's so case in point, because that's been done by... you know, every man and his dog around Sheffield gets done every weekend. And I've never seen anyone do the beat.
Oh, yeah. You go left hand to the lip, right?
Yeah.
I remember seeing the same thing. I was in Magic Wood a few years ago. And I remember watching a video of you doing practice of the wild.
Yeah.
And the most established beater these days is people just jump to a jug and like kind of skip the shoulder he cut. But the other way it had been done is going like left hand to a shoulder. Yeah. And then I saw you like setting up and I was like, oh, he's going to jump. And then he actually went right hand over, which I've never seen anyone do. So an interesting point you make, Sam.
I wonder if is that something that you take like extra pride in, to just be, you know, do you even watch videos of other people climbing, or do you just think, no, I'm just going to completely do it myself?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. And I think you're probably right that doing first ascents has made me increasingly get used to working out my own beta. And even if there is an established beta, I think, well, that's useful. And I do watch videos, but it's certainly not, I certainly don't take it as the last word. It's just like, well, that's how one person did it. I'm just so in the habit of finding out beta. And also, it's one of the, I would say it's the thing I enjoy most about climbing, full stop, is working out a good way. Just to, that, I think that sensation of where you look at the holds and then you think, oh, I'll try that. And then it just makes the move easier. That feeling is just like, that's the reward that takes you through the whole process of trying a project, you know, that doesn't make it demoralizing to try and fail, because every small increment of improvement gives you such a lot of pleasure that you've solved a little piece of the puzzle, and that means that the next bit might connect, and you just get to do that over and over again until you link the whole thing. Yeah, it's very, very rewarding.
But I'm curious, like on something like Keen Roof, which is like almost paint by numbers, or yes. So I thought anyway, because yes. Everyone's always done it the same way. Did you even try it the normal way first, or did you immediately just?
I did try it the standard way, but I found it a bit awkward, like that move. Like I'd get into the position, and then I feel like I just can't move. I mean, possibly it would be something that I probably could work out how to do it if I kept trying it. But it just, I could just see, I was like looking at that way, but immediately I was like, well, I just, my intuition is telling me to try it with the other hand. And immediately, as soon as I started to try that, I thought, that's more likely. That's going to go. Yeah. And it gives you more work afterwards because you have to do a funny hand swap afterwards. But you know, I sort of found a way to do that kind of a bit more efficiently.
Yeah, it's a great skill to have, because I tend to just look at videos and then try and just copy exactly what they've done. Even when I remember one time being out in Magic Wood, and I'd seen you do a very weird beater again on Riverbed.
Oh, yes.
Foot follow. And I remember being armed with that video, thinking, well, if the generic beater doesn't feel very good, then I'll do it this way, because that looks way easier. Yeah. And I was trying it the original way, and I thought, okay, right, now I'll try it Dave's way. And it was horrific. It was way worse. Right.
But I mean, I think that just tells you that, you know, everybody's body is so different. We've all got different attributes. Like, some people have got steely fingers. Some people are burly compression or have lots of body tension. Some people have got, you know, a long leg or a long arm, and you know, you can use those attributes. Yeah, I mean, I just find that my main attribute is weakness, but like I like figuring things out. So yeah, I just milk that for all it's worth, and it's just served me so well.
Yeah, it feels like it's quite a strong analogy to like the seemingly, from what I've read anyway, your approach, the science that you research as well, like in terms of that process of experimenting with something and being quite independent in doing so, being quite independent in that you perhaps wouldn't see what others have done before you and take that to influence your decisions. It feels, from reading your stuff, you've got quite like a analytical or rational, like science mindset. And I wonder if that is something which applied quite obviously to your approach to climbs as well.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Yeah, and I definitely do take that. Well, the approach is parallel. I've got into the habit of both. On the actual rock, figuring out sequences in a kind of organized way, a bit more of a deliberate way, if you like, where it's rather than just intuitively trying things. I suppose I do have a process where it's like, you know, I sort of come to look at like a boulder problem, like we're talking about Keen Roof, and just look at all the holds and have a broad brush picture of how you might approach it. And then there's like, you know, a different sequence takes you down a different path of moves between a small number of holds, and you work that out, and it will either take you that way or it'll take you that way. And you might have to work out two or three different ways at the same time and invest a bit of time in that, and then establish that one of them is probably going to be the one to go, and then you progress with that one and go into more and more detail. So I suppose it is a bit formulaic in a way, and it's true that I think about the whole of climbing like that, you know, the wider aspect of training, and things like, you know, asking questions of your approach, like even very basic questions like, you know, am I doing this right? Is this the way to train strength or endurance or technique or whatever, and going right back to basics quite often and thinking, am I doing this right? Could this be improved? But then going into real details as well. So it's just like, basically it's just questioning everything all the time. And I think the key attribute was, I thought Sam's question was really good about doing new routes, because the thing about doing new routes in climbing is being comfortable with uncertainty and just going with it and not needing like, oh, how does this, what grade is this climb? How do you do it? What's the beta? And what does the guidebook say? You don't have any of that. You just have to deal with the uncertainty and be like, well, I'm not going to find out the answers to these questions until I just go and try. And you get very, very used to that. And I find that when I think of questions that I'm interested in about training or science or nutrition, I'm quite comfortable with not knowing the answer, but you know, having bits and pieces of evidence or thinking that might lead you in a certain direction, but not holding on to them very tightly and being able to change my mind about them. So I really like that. I think it's very fun, and I think that's all science really, really is. It's just like formalized experiments. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. Ties in a lot of your mindset around climbing and your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that people are really excited about to ask you, and I'm guessing you're going to get this, you probably get this quite a lot already, and you're going to get it a bit more each year, but people really like to know how you felt like you've kept improving despite the fact you're getting older. Do you feel like you're still improving now?
Yes and no. Overall, I would say probably yes. Just thinking of like just general grades and my general climbing standard, it's fair to say I'm improving, although not dramatically, you know, just very, very slightly. But there are some things, sometimes I feel weaker, but I don't know if it's just because that's just a thought in my own head. Like objectively, you know, on a fingerboard, I can still do more than I could 10 years ago, and definitely more than I could 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So overall, yeah, I do feel like I am getting better. Although in parallel, there's lots of aspects of my body that I do feel my age a little bit. I have to work hard to keep various aches and pains at bay and look after myself quite well. A single night of bad sleep just has such a bigger effect than it did 20 years ago. So I do have to be a bit more disciplined in that respect. So sometimes there are some days where I sort of feel, oh, this is harder than it used to be. But most of the time, I don't. Most of the time, I just feel sort of the same challenges with looking after my body and performing as well as I can. Like it just feels the same as it did when I was younger.
yeah. And someone else asked, I'm going to change it very slightly, but do you feel like the improvement is slowing down as you get older, or is it just similar?
It probably is. I mean, if you just think of objectively of like what grades I've climbed, then it probably is. Maybe grades have changed, especially in trad. It probably changed a little bit and over the past 20 years. But in bouldering, yeah, I would say I could climb like, I don't know. I mean, this is the other thing with not traveling and doing mostly new routes. Like I had a spell like several years ago where I went to Switzerland quite a lot and went to some of the classic areas. I could climb 8B plus on my first trip to Magicwood, which kind of surprised me. I remember doing new baseline and being like, wow, I didn't think I'd be able to climb an 8B plus in that area. And then went back and subsequently the next year could even climb a few more a bit faster. And like the speed that I could do like 8A or 8A plus was definitely a bit faster than it had been before. But it's very hard to tell. Maybe I'm not improving. Maybe I am. It's funny. I don't think about it that much.
Yeah.
Just think about the next project. Yeah.
Much earlier on in the podcast, right at the start, I think you spoke about feeling like your limitation was most often weakness. Mm. I think I can't remember if it was. I've basically. From like just seeing the way you climb, I haven't actually climbed with you, but like from watching the way you climb, you really predominantly climb in like an open free finger.
Yeah, drag. I like the drag. Yeah,
and on a on a fingerboard, are probably somewhat of an outlier in strength in that position. You seem to be able to like quite comfortably one arm some quite bad holds and drags. Anyway, it feels like that is far from a weakness in many ways. Well, in that I'm awful at dragging basically, so can can't even hang off anything. And so for me, it's really impressive. But that has translated to the way you climb, because you do actually, like when you actually climb, that is a style in which you climb quite a lot. Do you find that when you're training and the improvements you make, it's within that style, or do you find that it's like diversifying from that somewhat? Because obviously there's limitations to every outlier in our strength. Do you feel like your improvements are made within that, or do you find yourself having to work on other attributes?
Oh yeah, I absolutely do work on other attributes. Although, like maybe many people, I probably should. There's probably room for rebalancing of my training to look at my weaknesses a bit better. I tend to milk that drag. I mean, it's very difficult. So, like, I feel like I respond to strength training on that three-finger drag more than with other grips. So therefore, I do it more. Now, is that a bad thing or a good thing? Like,
yeah, it's hard to tell, isn't it? You never know what could be.
So I've developed this one aspect of my, that I would say it's my best weapon, you know, so I've really like milked that. So that's probably a good thing. But, you know, that means that I'm sort of weaker in other areas. I think maybe full bodies, like my upper body power in general is quite poor, like doing compression and holding swings and things like that. I don't feel that good on that. I tend to keep my feet on a lot on boulder problems, and that tends to be stopper moves, is where there's like a cut loose. I just don't have that raw power to like get my feet back on. So should I spend more time working on that? Maybe that would rebalance it, or maybe it wouldn't. Maybe I don't have the capacity to respond that well to that. So it's hard to know.
Yeah, there's so many like physiological things play into it as well, don't they? You know,
but broadly, I do try to look after those different elements, and I do a bit. But yeah, I probably could be more disciplined than I am with allocating time to these different aspects. I'm quite free form in my training. I just tend to go bouldering on my board and hang off the fingerboard. But I enjoy just the bouldering. And that partly comes back to the actual goals. I mean, I do like to enjoy the climbing a lot. So I like both. I mean, I like the idea of improving, but I also like to just go on a board and just boulder. And just have fun. So there's always a balance between those two.
I always think that's quite funny, in that like often the style in which we end up climbing, we've slightly developed because of our preference for the way in which we move in doing so. The idea of always training your weaknesses, I'm a bit hesitant towards, because often they're probably our weaknesses, because we don't, like to some degree, they're probably our weaknesses because we don't, that's not the way we enjoy moving, or we probably got into climbing initially and learned to climb in a way which like felt good, and that's probably like somewhat dictated our style. So that's like, yeah, I'm never too sure about just working weaknesses being like a little catchphrase.
Yeah
it sounds good, doesn't it? But it's not always actually doesn't necessarily carry over. If you can do something in your own way, then getting as good as possible as your own way is probably a good idea.
Yeah
that's it. I mean, it's like what we were saying at the beginning about working out sequences. I mean, that's my other main weapon, is to find a good way. I mean, that if we were talking about Keen Roof, I mean, that method that I've got, and it just, I could just easily reach the hold on the lip just with a little pop, but I didn't really feel like I was using any power to do it. To have the ability to work out different a way that works really well for you just makes climbs a grade easier.
You did have a lattice assessment, didn't you? And I've seen that video, and we've got one of our patrons has asked about it. But you say, and I've heard you say before, that your weakness in climbing is your weakness. But in that assessment, I don't think you were under the average for most of those metrics from memory.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, I was quite strong for, I think, I can't remember exactly, but yeah, it was like sort of on the stronger side for 48B plus, I think. Which I think that broadly makes sense because, like, you know, I have climbed quite a lot of 48B pluses now. And, you know, I feel like if it was a bit stronger, I could climb 8C or even harder than that. And yeah, if it was, I mean, I'm not great at endurance either. So, like, yeah, I could climb 9A plus, I think, if I had just a little bit better endurance. But I always thought, like, that was one of the questions we went into in that video when I was with the Lattice guys, is saying, well, I don't feel like I've ever really properly trained endurance ever.
Mm.
I don't feel like I've ever really been fit. And maybe if I just did a very, very organized training program, I actually could get fit enough. And the reason I've never done that is because there's just not that much sport climbing in Scotland.
Mm.
And because I don't travel that much. And, you know, as time goes on, I travel much less. So bouldering and trad tends to take my focus, and sport climbing much less so.
And do you remember if there are any big surprises in that Lattice assessment?
Well, the main one was just that I was a bit stronger than I thought I was going to be. Yeah. I mean, it's a funny one, that idea of, like, so, I mean, you could say, well, okay, so I was kind of incorrect about feeling that I was weak for the grade that I climb, and that's apparently true, but maybe it's still advantageous to consider yourself weak.
Yeah, you then go about looking for the best way.
Yeah, if it drives strength gain. It wouldn't be if it distracts you from other things that would improve your climbing more. I have seen that with other climbers that I'm coaching, and I'm sure you guys have seen that loads yourself. Where you see someone who's convinced that they need to get stronger. I mean, I remember coaching someone, and it was a female climber, and they were exceptionally strong, and they were asking me to coach them because they wanted to do their first 8A sport route. And then I remember, like, we were bouldering, and I was just, like, so confused. I was like, watching their finger strength on boulder problems, I was like, no, you should be climbing your first 8C sport route, not 8A.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what is the problem? And then when we actually went sport climbing, I realized the problem was fear of falling. And they had really, really, really bad fear of falling as soon as they moved above the bowl. Their climbing style completely changed as soon as their waist went above the bowl. And I was like, yeah, that's where it's a real distraction. Like, you've got to reset your thinking and realize that finger strength is not your issue here.
It's hard to see our own limitations when we are challenged by something, and training and weakness is something that is easy to fall back on, because we don't have very many reliable formulaic things within climbing, but maybe training is one of the places where we're closest to that. There's a relatively good formula for, obviously it differs for each person and it requires some personal input. Generally, we know how to train and get a bit stronger. And so it's easy to fall back on that and not maybe have such, like, a holistic overview of what really is limiting us. But I think that's where a role of a coach is really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's right. Yeah. But I just remember you were talking about Dan Badian earlier. I mean, I remember going up to one of my own boulder problems in Glen Nevis with Dan and watching him on it. And I think he nearly did it in the day. I'm just thinking, yeah, God, he's just so much stronger than me. Yeah, way, way stronger. I mean, that's what it came down to. I didn't feel that he was, like, climbing it better than I'd climbed it. I think, if anything, it was, I had it wired. I took a long time to do it, so I had got a really nice sequence. But just watching him on it, I could see that slight inefficiency of someone who's only trying a problem on the first day. They haven't quite got it dialed yet, but he's still making it through the moves, and it's just strength, you know?
Yeah,
he was definitely more powerful. So, I mean, there is this issue of, like, maybe my basic strength is quite good if I'm hanging on a three-finger drag on a fingerboard, but that's not quite the same as actually doing a move on a problem. So it's, yeah, I'm not quite letting go of the idea that I'm weak just yet.
Oh yeah, I've spoken about that a little bit, about how, like, these kind of standardized metrics of strength can be quite reductive for climbing specific strength. And I see that a lot, like in terms of like personally find that usually I can be quite strong when I climb on boulders. Yeah. I can usually like powerful boulders, which require strength, usually suit me quite well. Yeah. However, when it comes to more basic testing, I fall short of the mark. Like I'm pretty average. Whereas like I don't necessarily go into trying boulders with that in mind, because I think, but I definitely used to, like I've somewhat dissociated being like, oh, well, I'm not strong on a fingerboard and therefore I'm not strong, to being like, actually, like I want to be strong on the boulders and I don't really mind that much if I'm not that strong on a fingerboard. And like, I'll train on it where it's applicable and where it's helpful for me. But like, there's some missing link, which is hard to understand because we all move in different ways. So it's very hard to generalize.
Climbing's a technical sport. I mean, I see people like talking to people, and also you see commentary online all the time on social media of people who are obviously, they're kind of both disappointed and a bit confused because they've reached a milestone of basic strength on a fingerboard and they can't understand why it's not translated to the grade that they're told it should translate to. I don't understand what's going on. It's just that there's so much more to climbing, even within the idea of strength, never mind technique and tactics and all those things.
No, it's definitely a fun one, but that's where the role of experimentation becomes necessary, which definitely seems up your street.
You've written a couple of books, Dave. The first one, 9 out of 10 Climbers Make the Same Mistakes, has been out for a pretty long time now. How long has that been out for?
Yeah, more than 10 years, 12 years or something.
If you were to rewrite it now, is there anything you think you would change or anything you left out that perhaps you should put in?
There's probably a couple of things that are slightly different now. I mean, the major thing is that climbing walls are so different to how they were at that time. Like climbing walls were still quite old school and like real rock climbing. And now, especially, you know, the big indoor bouldering centres, it's in the past 5 years, it's just sort of changed so much. And I definitely need to expand on commentary on the differences between the styles of climbing on those, in those places and outdoors, and emphasise what we've just been talking about how different the techniques required are, and also the strengths required to do hard bouldering or climbing in general outside. However, I would say that a lot of this, I when I wrote that book, I thought this book in general wouldn't be that relevant in 10 years, because I wrote it at the time when there was like a cusp between, before that period, there was hardly any information on how to improve at climbing and how to train for climbing. And then after that, there was just more and more. And that book came out just on the cusp of the transition from one to the other. And I thought, well, there'll be all this information. People will understand much better how to improve at climbing in 10 years' time. And the basic simple ideas, the simple principles in that book, because it's a very simple book with simple messages, and it would just not be relevant. But almost I think it's more relevant. I was really mistaken about that. I see like the same problems and potentially they're even deeper than they were, like the things that climbers say that I think, that's like such an obvious mistake.
Another mistake to add to it. 10 out of 11 climbers made
sense. Yeah, I was just thinking that as well. would you ever consider writing a sequel or volume 2?
I would. I mean, I've thought about how to do that, and had several different ideas. I'm sure I will do that at some point. I'm actually writing a different book at the moment. I'm just writing a book about mountain climbing, although it does stray onto some of that terrain. I always tend to, if I'm writing about a climb or an experience from my own climbing, to add something that might be useful or relevant to the person reading it. So although I'm writing a book about my own climbing right now, I am trying to say, like, this is how this could be, this story could be useful, and make sure I translate that. And it does stray onto that sort of terrain of thinking about things like the both the benefits and the downsides of switching between different climbing disciplines. You know, to give an example, sometimes like being a trad climber or a sport climber can be such a big advantage on in bouldering. I mean, last night I was just watching on YouTube. I was watching a video of Stefano Gasolfi climbing in Bishop, and he was climbing this 80 plus boulder, and it was great. He did like sort of 8 or 10 moves or something to the lip, and he was saying, "Oh yeah, it's got this little fingery finish," and it's just like the fingery finish was just like a few moves across the lip of the slab, but it was just like a little sting in the tail, you know, potentially you could fall there. And he hung on these holds for like a minute or maybe even more than a minute, just shaking out. And I was like, that's classic, you know. I bet like most hardcore boulderers wouldn't do that. They would just push through. And potentially they'd have a few tries where they would pump off on those final little crimpy moves. But he just shook out there and recovered and then finished it. And you often see that with people who gravitate towards bouldering. Like, they're good at it because they're quite explosive athletes and they're good at delivering a lot of power, but they're not good at managing that power. So like they're able to relax and focus for a second to place the foot on the foothold carefully and then switch back into that explosive power mode, or they do a few easy moves using minimal power and then switch to maximal power again, and vice versa. You get the sport climbers or trad climbers who are excellent on long pitches, but just they fall off the cruxes again and again because they don't have that snap. Yeah, so it's all those things. These are all basic stuff, but I think now think they'll be important messages to repeat forever, really.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a bit about that multiple discipline as well, because we've pretty much just spoken about bouldering, which is classic for me and Sam, because we do pretty much just boulder. It's amazing we haven't bought the schoolroom yet. But but yeah, obviously, as like a within the UK, I can't think of many people that participate or embark on all the disciplines like of climbing really to such a high level. Well, especially once you include winter climbing, there's not many people who winter climb, trad climb, sport climb, boulder, like all of it really. Is that just like, are you just passionate about all of those? Are you just driven to do that just because you enjoy doing it? And like, do you find that like the interaction between them is somewhat beneficial to maintain motivation? Is there crossover of them helping each other? Because it could easily be quite detrimental, I guess, by spreading yourself thin.
I think you're exactly right. I think I do just enjoy them all. And that's, I think I'm a product of the climbing culture I grew up in, you know, as a Scottish climber, with the mountains that we have and the climate that we have, it kind of dictates that you do better in lots of disciplines. And that's also the climbing culture that I downloaded when I started, that if you were a climber, it was just a given that you did everything. Actually, it was bouldering that was the kind of weird thing in Scottish climbing that few people did, except at Dumbarton Rock, which is where I started climbing. That was the one little corner of emerging bouldering culture in Scottish climbing. So I was part of that as well. That's how I ended up starting to do everything, and I've always enjoyed all of that. And there's parts of it, of the different disciplines that are complementary and parts that are detrimental. So I do think it's been detrimental to my bouldering that I've spent a lot of time carrying heavy rucksacks up mountains, and, you know, I've got big muscular legs. And I've spent a lot of time, you know, mincing about in corries and blizzards and not hanging off small edges and getting stronger, especially in my younger years. So in that sense, they can be detrimental. In other senses, they're complementary. Like I was just saying, you know, the ability to use techniques from different disciplines, like to be doing a hard boulder problem, but also be able to rest very well or climb easier sections of hard boulders with using as little power as possible. you know, things like that are really useful. And there's also certain trad techniques that you just think, oh yeah, I've just, you'll do a move sometimes. Like I was doing this problem in this cave the other day, and there's a bit where I did this like knee bar, but without a foot, if you like. I just pressed my knee up into an undercut. Mm. There was no foot to bar against. And I just kind of had this thought. It's like, that's such a traddy thing to do. Like, you know, when you're doing full body climbing, that's something that you would learn to do a lot if you're a winter climber, where you're like beasting up these big corners and weird features and like using snow and ice to help you make progress. So you learn to climb with your whole body in a way that I just think you wouldn't otherwise so much. And so I do find that those do overlap quite well. So there's a mix.
Yeah.
Yes. Something that Aidan said there momentarily is you do so many different types of climbing and seem to enjoy so many different types of climbing. Seems like you'd enjoy climbing the stairs, but like when do you find that that's what helps you like maintain motivation and psyche for climbing over such a long period of time?
I'm not sure about that, because I think I just do like climbing. I think if I only bouldered, I would love that as well. And if I only track climbed or only winter climbed, I could definitely do that. It maybe makes it easier through the year, especially dealing with bad conditions. I always remember observing that when I was I used to train in Glasgow Climbing Centre when I lived in Glasgow, and training a lot with a friend who only bouldered. And when conditions were poor, either through the summer or, in fact, in the winter when it was just raining a lot in Scotland, he would have long periods of being very frustrated. And I remember thinking, feeling a bit sorry for him and thinking, like, I don't have that, because like I've been out having these brilliant days out winter climbing. And it's given me, you know, just it has renewed my motivation. But I'm not sure. I think I would, even if I only did picked one discipline and only did that, I would enjoy it. I think I just seemed to like climbing a lot.
Do you ever still go into commercial centres? Do you ever climb commercial centres anymore?
That's a good question. I actually rarely do these days, because my ankles are in such a bad state. I can't jump down from a bouldering wall. Or I could, but it wouldn't work out very well if I did repeatedly. They're too high.
I noticed that. They are so... I find... Because I mostly just train on a board. And I have a pretty chronically bad ankle as well. But I find climbing walls these days, when I have a rare session in bouldering walls and you get to the top of a boulder and jump down, the following day, like, not only does my ankle flare up, but like, my quads and my glutes are just annihilated. They're so tired.
Yeah. It's something that, I mean, if there's someone that wants to do a long-term study, I think that would be a good one to do, is just to follow up like lower body musculoskeletal problems in boulderers who habitually climb in these places. I kind of do slightly worry that there might be a cost to jumping down from bouldering walls for 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. Anecdotally, from the boys from the county, Northumberland, the amount of them with hip replacements it doesn't fill you with optimism.
Your training now, Dave, is basically just getting outside, doing whatever you can, whatever's in condition. And if it's not in condition, you're on your bouldering wall at home.
Yeah, that's right. I've got a brilliant bouldering wall at home. It's big. I mean, I've got a double garage, so it's like I've got a big 45 board and a 15 degree board on the other side. So it's a great setup. It's really, really fun. So, I do like climbing in there, but not nearly as much as outside. So I still do most of my climbing outside whenever I can. But there usually is a period about now, you know, December, January, where it gets to be a bit desperate. And it does make sense just to go on the board. But I actually spend the most time on it in the summer. When, like, we tend to get good weather in the west of Scotland through the spring. But usually at some point in June, it craps out. And then July and August are usually pretty wet. It's like wet, humid and midgy. And if you get a good high pressure, then you go out track climbing in the mountains. But the period in between, if you can't get up into the high mountains and get the cool conditions and get away from the midges, going climbing in the glens is not always as good. So that tends to be when I do the most training on the board.
Mm. And do you still enjoy the scary side of trad just as much as you used to? Because I know the scarier stuff you've done, I'm thinking of like Rhapsody and Echo Wall and stuff. That's quite a long time ago now. Have you done as many scary things recently?
Yeah, I would say I have, like a couple of years ago, I did a route called Mind Riot, the KB10, and that's definitely as hard and scary as anything I've done. I still definitely have a big appetite for it. And I mean, I'd say like the most, my diet of scary climbing is mostly in winter climbing. Like doing new routes on the bend, you're just kind of pushing up ground quite often with not great protection, and you're just getting further and further away from your gear, and you don't know if the route's doable. And that's the most intense sort of scary stuff. Like head pointing stuff on hard trad, I still really enjoy, and I think I'll keep doing that. My appetite for doing that's not really changed much. I still really like it. I mean, I possibly wouldn't be so keen on doing masses of unpredictable routes, and by that I mean things like smeary slabs with no protection. Like, I've not got that much desire to go and do a bunch of gritty 8s and E9s that are just like smeary slab fests, where it's like if your foot skitters off one smear, you're going to smash your legs. I'm less keen on that. I'm more keen on actually harder routes in the mountains that are just really great lines. That I'm really keen for. And if it's a really good line, then I'm perfectly willing to accept poor protection. But I don't feel like I ever, especially these days, I don't feel like I ever take that much risk on the head points.
It can be quite informed head pointing, can't it?
Yeah.
I think I've often listened to you discussing routes, it's very calculated.
Yeah.
Whereas winter routes, there's a lot more random. Or there's a lot more uncertainties.
Yeah, you have to stay quite conservative, but it's always tempting to not be conservative just to keep going. So it certainly feels scary. Usually it works out, and that's why you keep doing it, because you know if you push on a wee bit, you're thinking, well, I'll probably get a piece of gear, and you usually do. But it's just scary because you're not sure if you're going to or not. But yeah, for example, like I did that route Lexicon in the lakes in the spring, and you know that route, like if you fell off the last move, you could potentially hit the ground if things went badly from a long, long way up. But, you know, I led it after I top roped it 9 times out of 10.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And the one time that I didn't do it, that was like when I was pushing it, when I'd worked on it and then linked it cleanly 3 times in a row. And I was tired at the end of the session. And so I tried again, almost deliberately, to feel like, how does it feel when I'm more tired, when I'm going to fall off? So that you have a reference, like if I'm leading and I wobble on this move, I know I'm going to fall off the last move, so therefore I won't go any higher. So that one time when I did fall off, like, was sort of unnecessary. You know, I knew I was going to fall off it. So really, I was very consistent and before I would actually even decide to get on lead.
Yeah, yeah. Does it feel dangerous when you are so well prepared?
I think so. Yeah, and I think it's important that it does feel dangerous, because like you do have to take it seriously. Like at the end of the day, when you lead it, you still have to put yourself up there, and you still have to make damn sure you don't fall off that last move. And you know, if you're not climbing well and you don't nail it, then you could fall off it, and you know, it could go badly. So yes, it's important that even if you're operating within your margin, that you make sure you're paying attention. Yeah. I mean, I remember there was one time I fell off an E9 in Glen Nevis and I broke my ankle. And afterwards I thought, like, did I do anything wrong there? And I kind of thought, maybe I was a little bit too relaxed. Like, I was a little bit too not scared. Like, I've got this in hand. Like, I'm going to just do it. And I felt like maybe I wasn't scared enough.
It can, yeah, easy to get, like, complacent almost.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's definitely the most extreme injury I've ever had from just bouldering on a kind of a high ball. Was literally I was walking, didn't have my hands. I was just like walking up the slab at the top of it, basically. And it's kind of that idea of like, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't dangerous at all. But like, yeah, if you don't appreciate where you are, like, it's very easy to.
Yeah, mountaineering's good for drumming that into you. You know, if you spend a lot of time on mountaineering terrain where you're moving over easy ground, but you're still in a situation where you mustn't fall, you realise that it is easy to just, like, trip on a, like you say, on an easy slab or a ridge or whatever, or not pay attention and have a fall that's actually really serious. So mountaineering is good for training you to just have a degree of care at all times when you're in that sort of terrain.
But you're so considered, Dave, but wasn't one of your worst injuries abseiling off the end of a rope? Wasn't that?
I got lowered off the end of a rope.
Lowered off the end of the rope.
Yeah, on an easy sport route. And yeah, I mean, that's just a classic case in point of paying attention to basics, you know, where I'd bolted a new route and it was a 6B, but it was often wet. And it was about to rain, so I was in a bit of a hurry. And my friend was abseiling down with my rope to take a picture. So we used this other rope that a friend had stashed at the crag. And I didn't know that it had been cut, so it was a bit short. And I didn't pay attention, and I didn't think about that. So that's how that accident came about, where you're like, with hindsight, you're like, oh yeah, I should have actually checked, but it didn't come into my mind.
Yeah. How far did you fall?
Oh, like 20 feet or something like that.
Oh God, quite a long way.
But you know, if it's happened to you, like when you're hanging on a piece of gear and it rips or whatever, when you're hanging on a rope and you're being lowered and you feel you're in safety and then all of a sudden you're dropping, you kind of have this second where you're just, you don't know what's going on, like what's happening. And in that time, my ankle just clipped a ledge and that just totally destroyed my ankle. Someone fell down the crag and wrapped myself around a birch tree.
Yeah, because your body almost relaxes in that scenario. Whereas if you take a fall onto a bit of gear, you're kind of like tense up, kind of prepared to hit something.
Impact, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but how do you control that one?
But there's a lesson in that too, isn't there?
Yeah,
there is. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are simple things, and I mean, I've been fortunate that I haven't had many friends who have had fatal accidents. Just a couple, but you know, obviously, if you live a life doing trail climbing, you see plenty of accidents that people get away with or just have some moderate injury from. And you do learn all the time, but the consistent thing is, you know, preparation. Preparation is key, like anticipation of what could go wrong, and kind of planning for it. Just being thorough with the basics. I mean, the amount of climbers that I know who have decked out from not finishing time or not is ridiculous.
Yeah,
it keeps happening. Yeah.
Crazy, isn't it?
Stories like that, they're not like, it's not like they haven't been communicated well as well, like Lynn Hill's book like talks about it in like the opening paragraph, opening chapter or something, doesn't it? Like, it's like
that's right. You just always think of that as being a freak accident that happens to other people and you would never do that, but yeah, humans make mistakes, so you've got to have a system in place to account for that.
Yeah. Well, have you got any more questions, Sam?
No, I was just about to say that seems like
I actually just caught the time, and that is amazing, because that didn't feel like a very long conversation for me. But Dave, we've taken up hours of your time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
But I hope it was an okay conversation.
Oh yeah, totally, and good effort on doing the podcast. It's always really, really good to people make the effort to produce these things.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's always quite a thing, isn't it, to produce any kind of media. You always makes you worry. But it's really nice to chat to you.
Yeah,
to meet you after so many years of following your endeavours.
Yeah, no, pleasure, yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time. No, I really, really appreciate that, Dave. Well, lovely to speak to you, Dave, and hope you get some favourable weather.
No worries, thank you again.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. See ya.
See you later.
See ya.